Okay, let's give a rousing welcome for our warm-up speaker, Don.
Good evening. My name is Don. I'm an alcoholic. One of the ladies went up to our main speaker and said, you know, don't be nervous. Says, just look out there and think that they're all naked. So at this time, I'd like the ladies to move forward and the guys to move back. Okay, I guess this happens when you get my age. I come into Alcoholics Anonymous August 21st, 1973. I've been sober for 41 years. And it's all due to the grace of God and the fellowship of you people throughout the world. I got sober in the alcohol rehab in Charleston, South Carolina. And I was thinking today, you know, could it be any other way? They put me in this rehab unit. I was charged with DUI, resisting arrest, and attempted jailbreak. And for a sailor, that's a pretty damn good night. You know I had fun, right? But my captain was not very happy with me, so I wound up in that unit. When I went to my first AA meeting, I was like, I was very nervous. I was shy. I would sit over there and I wouldn't speak. My wife was, I didn't wake up one morning and decide to get sober. I woke up one morning and the world decided I was going to get sober. And so my family, my job, the whole works. The world was out to get me. And I really didn't know how to handle that. And I thought this rehab unit would just be a nice little break, you know, and I would have 6 weeks in this naval hospital and there would be nothing else but doing whatever they had to do. But that very night I checked in, they put me in the back of the Scrambler station wagon and drove me 2 blocks to my first AA meeting. And I didn't know what to expect. I didn't expect people like you to be there. You know, I expected something, I don't know what I expected, but I was surprised. And unfortunately, the other thing that blew me away was that they come up and said, my name is so-and-so and welcome. We're glad you're here. If you have any questions, you know, let us know. We'll be glad to talk to you after the meeting. You need a phone number? Here's my phone number. That kind of world I didn't come from. We don't do that in bars, unless it's a lady, you know. And most of the ladies give me the wrong number anyhow. You know, but the thing of it was is that I did not recognize this side of life. I was raised by an alcohol. My dad was an alcoholic. My mother was pretty much that way. And the psychological term they use is a dysfunctional family. We were, you know. Instead of, I could remember Christmas Eve or my dad would be passed out in the bathtub, you know. And his kids were waiting for him to wake up so he could open our Christmas presents. And I swore I'd never do that. And when I had my kids and I started drinking on Christmas Eve, I'd be damned if I didn't wake up in a bathtub. You know, my kids were disappointed, you know. And my wife didn't drink at all. So you knew what kind of life I had there, you know. In fact, at the end of my drinking, and this is one of the milestones or one of the things that I recognize as the end, was the fact that I had made this woman so unhappy and so miserable, she told me this, that there would never be a divorce. Her whole goal in life was to make me as miserable as I'd been her. You know, August we celebrated 50 years of being married. But we also have to tell you that there's also been 41 years of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's also been Al-Anon involved. There's been friends and real friends coming in, you know, saying, Don, you need to look at this, you know. The first thing I had to learn was from my second sponsor was how to treat my wife and treat my family. That's what that guy's, that was the whole reason I picked him up. And he took me through part of the book that talks about the family afterwards, you know, and they explained my bizarre behavior, you know. And one of the things that you could find out with this alcoholic is when I was drinking, some days I would be just fine and some days I wouldn't be fine. And the word that they use is predictability. I had no predictability. You didn't know what was going to happen with God. And that even carried on into sobriety, you know. And I had to learn how to be predictable, you know, to do this, react the same way every time to the same situation, you know. I have four kids, and I was fortunate my wife kept them together, you know, and I remember AA friends taking my boys, you know, and one of them was having a problem with, I guess they call it huffing, smelling gasoline, and that was my second sponsor that got him. He retired from the Coast Guard, and very proud of this man. And he works up in Everett, Washington. He's a bodybuilder. I mean, he can lift the buildings up. He's just massive muscle, you know. And then I have daughters and another son that works down in San Diego. I got a daughter that works in the prison system. I got a daughter that works in elderly care in Delano. And they don't seem to have a problem in life that I had getting along with other people. The other thing that in my journey is even after a period of time, it was about 25 years, and my wife nailed me one night, and I never thought about it until she nailed me, and she says, "Don, do you like me? And I said, "Donnie, I love you." That's her name, Donnie. "I love you. I love you." I said, "We've been together all this time." And she says, "No, do you like me?" And I couldn't get where she was coming from. I knew it was an Al-Anon trap. But it was a thought-provoking trap that come to the point was that, you know, why can't you treat me like you treat your friends in Alcoholics Anonymous? Because I was leaving her behind. You know, she wasn't going to the meetings. When we first started out, we went to a meeting on Friday night. The only thing that we had enough money for was to go to Bob's Big Boy and get two cups of coffee and a piece of pie, shared strawberry pie, you know. And that's how we come back together. That was the starting of it. We all developed professionally. My job on the ship, when I went into treatment, my captain didn't want me back, but there was a ruling in the Navy that they had to take me back. I screwed it up so bad there that I had no credibility at all. And I didn't think I would ever get any credible. I didn't think I'd ever get recommended for promotion again. But by going to the meetings, doing what I was supposed to be doing, talking to my sponsor. And one of the things my sponsor emphasizes is if you get that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and you look at that first 164 pages, you know, but the one thing is just before the steps, it took me 3 months to figure out what the hell they were talking about. This is precisely how we stayed sober. Step one. Step two. It took me 3 months to figure it out. All right? And it didn't mean I jumped on it right away. I just thought it was kind of neat how they put that there, but I didn't jump on it right away. In fact, the only thing I've ever done in my life in moderation is the steps. You know? All right? And the only time I get into the steps is when I really get seriously in trouble with people, places, and things. That's what alcoholics live for, up here, people, places, and things. That was me. The thing that I could never figure out in the beginning was that phrase, "You've got to give it away to keep it." You know, and there was people that would say, I went on 12 steps calls with my first sponsor. This would be 2:00 in the morning. That was before they had these answering services. When they had an answering service, they called and they got you up and you'd go over somebody's house and you see the holes in the wall and the kids crying and the wife over in the corner, you know. I identified with that right off the bat. I knew what was going on in that house, you know. And I didn't see how that was going to benefit me until the next morning when I woke up beside my wife, you know. There was no new holes in the wall. She wasn't crying. And the kids are usually in there trying to get us up to do something, you know. You know, I grew from that experience. I developed an attitude of gratitude. You know, and that's where I come, just for the grace of God, there goes I. Over the time I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's been my misfortune to see people pass away from this disease, you know. This is a very serious disease, and they die at the ripe old age of 23, 24, 40, 45. We don't know when it's going to come, you know. The most dangerous thing in the world is a drunk with a gun, you know. You read in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they describe different types of alcoholics. I would be the type that does a depression, the one that they can write volumes on. And you can write volumes on my recovery, because it takes every day of my life to stay away from alcohol and to ask this God in my understanding, you know, to help me get through this day. And my first introduction to God was through that prayer. God, help me get through this day. My sponsor was a big guy. He was bigger than I was. He was a torpedoman, so it was very competitive, because I didn't like gunners, mates, or torpedoes, you know. But anyhow, and he was in the right mindset as me. He had an entry in his service record that he was not allowed to go back into a combat zone because he was too dangerous, you know, because he'd come out of a blackout with a machine gun in his tent in Vietnam. They would never take him back in country, never gave him security clearance, and he wasn't allowed around any weapons. But he would say things like, "Don, I don't know if this God we got here in Alcoholics Anonymous is going to open the gates of heaven and let you in, but I guarantee if you get down on your knees and ask him, he'll open the gates of hell and let you out." And I didn't understand that phrase until he told me, "In the morning, I want you to go down. When you get your shoes, I'm just going down on your knees and say, God, don't let me get into any trouble that you can't get me out of today." And that was usually a pretty big chore in my life. And if I made it through that day without drinking, I was supposed to, when I put my shoes back down underneath that bed, I was supposed to say, thank you, God, for this day. He said, "I want you to do that for 30 days. You know, and I did it for 30 days. And I don't know what changed. You know, I don't know when the change come, but something changed. I was no longer afraid to say God. That word, that term, didn't bother me. I was raised in a Pentecostal church, quote unquote, if that's what you want to call it. But I was taught that basically I was going to go to hell because I didn't eat my peas. And when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, there's nothing to forgive. We just need to let you get rid of your old ideas. All right? Join us in a fellowship. And we're not a glum lot. I mean, we have fun. Even though the girls wouldn't come up front tonight, but that's fine. We still have fun. All right? I retired from the Navy, and then I retired about 5 pay grades higher than I ever figured I'd make it. There was no way in hell. I was in the Philippine Seas. I run destroyers. Most of these people around here are from the air community, on airplanes or aircraft carriers. I run the little guys. I'm the guy that's chasing in behind the time. But anyhow, my boss come up, and it was hot, and I worked in the engine rooms, and I was between the stacks on this destroyer, and he come up here and he said, "I want you to sign this paperwork here, Chief." I said, "What's this for?" He says, "This is for the Warrant Officer LDO program." And I said, "Dave, there's no way they're going to do this." He says, "I'll bet you a steak." And that's, you know, he went right to my ego. And I took the bet, you know. And I told him, I said, "Look," I said, "I've been in 2 alcohol rehabs and a nut house. There's no way in hell they're going to make a naval officer out of me. I guess I fit the quota, right? Fit right in there." They made one out of me, you know. So I was able to retire with some dignity and some pride, you know. And then I went out into the independent power fields. And I used to work in the geothermal fields where they produce power out of geothermal fluid. And I even had a real unique job. Was my last independent power was down in El Centro, California. Did you know that an average steer produces 12.5 pounds of mass a day? And I was burning 1,100 tons of that producing electricity for 16,000 homes, you know. And it was a smelly job, but it was kind of neat. You know, unfortunately, we could never make it work in this country because of all the pollution and laws we have to deal with. You know? Then I went to work for the state of California in the Department of Corrections, and I fit in right there. That people identify with me real well, especially in the education. You know, I was able to communicate with them. You know, and I had to retire. I went into the engineering section of for the state, and I got where I couldn't climb up the ladders and get on the roofs where most of my equipment was, so I retired. So I'm walking around out there in the street. I am not going to be useless. I refuse to be useless, and I'm not going to be called lazy or inefficient or not resourceful. Some idiot put a thing on the back of the school bus that says, "Looking for school bus drivers, we'll train." Then I became a school bus driver in Porterville. And things with my military background and my prison background, sometimes they thought maybe I ought to tone it down a little bit. You're scaring these kids, you know. But the kids had we had a great time, you know. We always had something going on, you know. I had something going. I learned something from them. I didn't have to get so nutted up on the highway with all these crazy people up here anymore. You know, the guy cut me off. I said, "Yeah, that's a 5-pointer. You know, if somebody really cuts me off good, I give them 10 points, you know, instead of a finger, you know. Or you yell something obscene with somebody's 6-year-old behind me, you know. I learned how to deal with it. What I do today is I try to stay in service. Like I said, I don't know, I'm kind of giving up on the cooking area. You know, I worked with Marcy, and we cooked for the New Year's and the breakfast meetings. But, you know, we'll find something new. We cook for a bunch of bikers. That's a lot of fun, too. You know, they go out there and we make beef stew for them. I never seen 25 gallons of beef stew just goes like that. Them guys can put it away, you know. And that's neat. I'm coming up onto my 42nd Christmas sober. I'll tell you about the first one, and then I'm going to shut up. Yeah. The first one, I didn't have any money. All right. The Christmas presents were all that plentiful around the house. I had 4 little kids, and Minerva Chapel had a candlelight meeting, and. It was kind of like tonight. It was kind of rainy, drizzly. And then we went over there about 11 o'clock, and then us, all those drunks, were going to go home and put the toys together for the kids. And we went home and put what toys we had together for the kids, and they got this call. And I had to go back over to chapel because I worked on cars quite a bit. I tinkered with that stuff. And there was a guy out there in a wheelchair that couldn't get his car started. And I had to put a starter in his car, you know. And that was when I really felt grateful and proud to be part of this program. I understand what giving away really meant, you know. He couldn't pay me any money, and I wouldn't have taken any money anyhow, you know. It was just the idea that I had something that somebody could use, and I could give it away free. Merry Christmas, and I hope to see you next year.
Give a rousing Tulare County welcome to our featured speaker, Tim.
I brought my tissue. My name's Tammy. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 7, 2009. I was born and raised in Porterville. I had a loving family. I had good friends, went to school, and, you know, a great support group. My family, my mom and dad, they were drinkers, but they never drank during the week. And if they did, they didn't pay consequences for the next day, so they always went to work. But on the weekend, they did drink, and they would get, you know, to a fun place. I always thought they were having fun. It looked great. You know, we were having fun as kids. We'd be up to the lake a lot. You know, they would drive us home after they'd been drinking. We'd be in the back of the truck. No big deal, you know. So for a long time, when I got in high school, I thought drinking and driving was legal. I really did not know it was not. So, but I did learn that. My first drunk was my freshman year during winter around this time. And the first time I drank, I got wasted and I loved it. I was sliding out on the grass because there was like the frost over the grass, and we were just having fun out there. And from that day forward, I loved it. So every time I drank to get drunk. There wasn't, and if we were just going to have a couple beers, I was like, what's the point? I might as well not drink. Both sides of my family have a history of alcoholism, and they have a history of mental health as well. The first time I noticed I had a problem was when my daughter was in fourth grade, and I had to go, they asked me to volunteer as a parent to go to like a gold rushing community and stay the night with her. And so I said I would. I thought about how am I going to drink, you know, what am I going to do? So I thought about that, and then and so I decided to go and everything, and that there was a guy, a father on the bus, who we stopped in this little gold rushing town, and he went into the bar and had a drink, and I was like, that's brave of him. But I didn't do it. I drank root beer with the kids and everything. So we stayed a few nights overnight, and I started like really obsessing about alcohol, like how am I going to get it, I need it, I'm not feeling right, you know, what's going on. And I managed to get home, and the first thing I did was drink. So I was married to my husband at a very young age. I married him at 19. We were, you know, pretty successful early on. I went to school, I got my bachelor's degree, we owned our own business. His dad had owned a business and passed it down to us. And so we were doing good. And it was right about that time when we came into this money and me going to school and everything going well, is, you know, I started sabotaging myself. I didn't realize what I was doing at the time, but like, he's a drinker and he continues to drink. And I noticed our daughters were in sports, so we traveled a lot for softball. You know, we were down south, up north. She had pitching lessons in Bakersfield. She played for Fresno Forest, so we were all over. So we were at different places, different times, and we were always drinking. There was never a time we drove in the car probably without having a drink with us. And my kids saw that, and, you know, to us it was no big deal. It's like, that's just what you do. And when we would go places, he started like drinking with other people, and kind of I was drinking alone, so I would go up and try to be around him, and like he would move on and drink and stuff. So I started drinking more and started being more of a part of him and his friends. And I think that's when my drinking became more than, you know, a normal drinker. I was still able to go to work. I carried it, you know, had a job, and I worked for Porterville Adult Day Services, and I was a program director. And so I started there in 1995, and it was probably in 2005, 10 years after I started working there, we had a death in the family. And since we had the house and we had the setup, we had the gathering afterwards at our house. I had gotten some fight with my husband. I don't even remember what it was. And, you know, I always felt I was controlled by him. I tried to do the drink when he drank. I tried to, like, set my beer down, but I would always go run to the car and down one because I couldn't, you know, he always called me out on it. he didn't have the consequences I had. He was just a functioning alcoholic, and he still is. So when we, in 2005, when we had that death in the family, we had the gathering, I got mad at him. I went over to my best friend's house, and I had already been drinking probably from the time I got up to go to the funeral. And I went over there, and I was just downing vodka. And, you know, I went to go home. On my way home, I hit a parked car. It was right about 2:30 in the afternoon in front of Burton Elementary School. Kids should have been getting out at that time, crossing the crosswalk, but there was nobody around. I drove my car home. Everything was dragging from the bottom. There was like fire on the road, sparks fly. There was a guy who followed me home to make sure I got home safe. So here I come in, and I had torn down this person's property in their mailbox and went over the lawn, and definitely, you know, you could tell something had happened there. So the guy followed me home, and I gave him a thumbs up, like, I'm here to home, I'm good. And I walked in, and I was, you know, they came out because they heard my car coming into the garage and everything. My mom's all, what happened? I'm like, I hit a mailbox, it's okay. And they were like getting on me, and my mom goes, we got to come up with something. Call Missy, tell her to go put a note on their mailbox to let them know that nobody was home, that we'll come back to the scene, and we'll take care of it. But nobody was there for us to take any information or do anything, my mom being the codependent mom that she is. So they called. My mother and I had went back. My mom was going to take the fall for it because she had not been drinking. And I was just going to go and be there with her, which was a bad idea. I get there, they're questioning her, and they said, we're asking her some other questions that she really didn't have the answer to. And here I go with my mouth, and I said, you know what? I effing did it. You want to do something about it? Then do it. And the guy looked at me, the cop, and he immediately placed me under arrest, put me in the back of the cop car, and, you know, had a little talking to my mom, had a little talking to me, and, you know, at that moment, I was still, I was all, I don't care if you take me in. I know people in the PD. They'll get me out. My cousin's brother-in-law, he's a highway patrol, and I was throwing out names, think I this, and he was pissed. He was very upset. So I went home after that. I didn't want to go to Johnny's house, my husband's, our house, because he's the reason this happened. So I went to my friend's house, and, you know, I continued to drink. I was scared. I was like calling the DA every other day to see what my charges were. For some reason, you would think it would be a great wake-up call that, Tammy, you're going to get your stuff together now and you're going to learn. They didn't press charges. So I was fortunate, but I didn't learn my lesson. And we continued to drink. Our relationship continued to be toxic. I felt he was controlling more. He was controlling me and the kids. We were like going our separate ways. In 2007, my dad passed away unexpectedly. And I felt from my dad that I was controlled at a very young age. He was the type to sit on the couch, and we would bring him everything, the remote control. We had a cooler. We had to get up and turn on and off every time he needed it on. And just little stuff that, you know, he was the guy that would sit in the chair and dictate what goes on. And if you were going to get disciplined, he would call you to him. And I'm looking at him like, heck no, I'm not coming to you. I came to him a couple of times and, you know, got my butt whooped. But so as I got older, I just like run the other way, like catch me if you can, you know. Like, so after he died, I don't know what had happened. I was working at Porterville Adult Day Services. I was going to school for my bachelor's degree. I just wasn't into my marriage anymore. I wasn't feeling supported, feeling that way myself. But I was drinking a lot more, and I started not being able to cope well. And I went to work. I was drinking at work. And this one certain day, I had drank a lot. And I went into work after I had been there like 13 years. and I'm like really not with it and stuff, but I think I am. I think I'm doing a great job. I'm pretending well, you know. I even get up on the roof to help Don Hilligas clean out the gutter because, you know, we were cleaning out expecting rain and stuff, and I got up there and I'm all tipsy, and he's like, Tommy, this is, and I cannot a safe place to be. We need to talk. So I, from my recollection, we went downstairs and it happened in the kitchen area, and he called me out on it. He said, you've been drinking, you know, whatever he says, this needs to stop. And I said, you know what, I don't need this job. I'll quit. That day, after 13 years at a place that I enjoyed working, I walked out on. And the reason, like, I had Don be my 10-minute speaker, at the time I was pissed. I did not care for Don. I was upset with him. Sherry would not let me come back to work. But truly, he was my intervention. So, needless to say, after I quit my job, I went to, I was drinking more and more, and I had conned the doctor. So right when I quit my job, I went to the doctor and said, I'm an alcoholic, I need help. So like within 2 days, I got on disability. That was my thing, you know, because I was a good manipulator. I wasn't owning up to things, and that's what I did. I went back to live with my husband, and I got into outpatient. And when I was an outpatient, Johnny would go with me. My mother supported me the whole time. My sister had been through the NA thing, and she was like leaving pamphlets and doing the tough love and all of this stuff, get it together. And so I went to outpatient at Korea Delta, outpatient, and I would go and I would listen, and I would get some things, and I would, me and my husband would be going, and then like we would leave and he'd say, so you're never going to be able to drink again? And I'm like, no. He goes, so you mean we can't go to the beach and have a glass of wine once in a while? I'm like, no. And he just couldn't deal with that. That's something that he wasn't willing to give up. It's to support me, and it wasn't something that I could live with. I couldn't be around somebody that continues to drink while I didn't. You know, I couldn't do that. So it continued to get worse. I continued to drink more. I was going to the outpatient and I got called out. They said, someone in here smells like alcohol. I'm like, not me. And they're like, somebody better own up to this. I'm looking at her and I'm looking at him. I'm like, who's drinking? She goes, I will get the breathalyzer out right now and test every one of you. I'm like, okay. So here she comes with the breathalyzer. I go, you know what? I drank. Kick me out. You're going to kick me out because here my ego comes into it. So I got kicked out that night. I would return if I agreed to renew my contract and sign in. And I was doing that for a long time, and I was going to meetings, but I couldn't stay sober. I continued to drink. I continued to be angry about my situation. I continued to hate the people that called me out on stuff, you know, and it came to a time where I was going to my children's school functions drunk. I was taking Xanax. So I would literally pass out at their events. They were so embarrassed and ashamed of me. People would call the cops on me. They would show up at the Menachie High School softball games. They would take me, talk to me, and I would have a ride and go home. And that continued for a long time. I could not get sober to save my life. I tried so many times, but once I had a little bit, there was a control issue that I felt like, you know, I can drink. You know, nobody can control me. If I want to drink, I'm going to drink, because I thought, you know, I was getting sober for all the wrong reasons. I was getting sober for my children, for my mom, you know, and for my employment. So I can never stay sober, and we were starting to go through a divorce, and you know, I still had the children part of the time, and I remember going to San Diego, and we got there, and you know, I had stayed sober until we got to San Diego. When I arrived in San Diego, I was starting to have a little the shakes and like not feeling right and needing to drink, and that obsession came over, so I stopped, and I had a Cadillac CTS, and I had this little thing in the trunk, had Velcro and a little thing, and it pulled down. That's where I'd stash my alcohol, because nobody would know it was in there. So I had a bottle in there, and when I got there, I drank it. And then the next day, I didn't have alcohol, and my friend was with me, my children were with me, and they knew I was trying to get sober, so no one's, you know, my friend's not drinking, and I can't just take off to the liquor store like I normally do, because I'm trying to play it, because if anybody knows I'm drinking, those kids won't be a part of my life. So I remember at that night, my friend had a beer in her, she had a few beers in her refrigerator, and at like 11:30 at night, I went, I sneaked to the kitchen, I grabbed one of her beers, I went out back, I didn't have a can opener, I could not open it with my teeth, and I could not screw it off. So here I am with that bottle, this is how desperate I was, banging it on the sidewalk till it broke off. Half of it spilled out, but I was drinking it because my body at that time needed it. And the things you do, you know, to in your disease. So after that, we were leaving. I stopped at the store. I said, I'm getting gas. And I went in, and I got a pint of alcohol, and I downed it in the restroom. So from the time I left San Diego to the time I got to Porterville, I was in a blackout with my children in the car. I don't remember a lot of things. I remember some things. They were very scared when they got home, so I don't know what I was doing on the road, if I was cutting people off, flipping people off, telling them to sit down and shut up. I have no idea because of that blackout. The next day, the friend that was with my daughter, her mom's a teacher's aide. She did a CPS report on me from what her daughter had told her. So I had CPS knocking on my door, but I played it off. I said, no, I work. I wasn't drinking, you know, this and that. So they didn't do anything about it at that time. And so I still had my children going through a divorce. I was living in a new place because I was getting my disability check, and I was stealing checks from my husband's business out of the mailbox because he had moved all his money into another account. So I was stealing his checks and cashing them to make everything, and then my mom was assisting me with other money to pay my bills. So I had my children part-time. There was a softball game in Hayward, and there was another softball game down south. So my husband chose to take my oldest down south. I was taking my middle child, and everybody still thought I was getting it together, going to meetings, staying sober. And I could hold it together for a while, but then I would just sabotage it again. So they had all the softball parents were going out, and I said, yeah, I'll watch the kids. I'll stay home. Little did they know I had a bottle, you know, in my home, in the motel room. I don't know what happened from the time I drank the bottle till the time I was being hauled off 5150 in the back of an ambulance, but what they tell me, I was in a rage. I was being really abusive and mean to my children. I was scaring the friends that were with me. My daughter called my mom. My mom from Porterville called PD, Hayward PD. Hayward PD called the ambulance and notified the parents, and they were hauling me off in the ambulance. So leave it to me. I'm telling the ambulance driver, he did the 5-point restraint. I said, if you're going to restrain me and I'm going to pay for this ride, you better have the lights and sirens going. And here I was thinking, you know, I was funny, but, you know, that's just where I was in my disease. If I'm going to pay for this, you better turn those lights on and get us there fast. So I was 5150 overnight, and I had already attempted to cut my wrist prior to that, and if anybody would have pulled up my sleeves, I have cuts on my arms, they would have known. So the therapist or psychologist, who she is, came in, and I was sitting there in restraints, and she said, so, do you want to harm yourself? I'm like, no. She goes, do you want to harm anybody else? I'm like, no, I don't, you know, I just was drunk. And so I conned her. I got out of there within the next morning when they had the tournament, and they called me, the ninth hospital called me a taxi because, you know, they were responsible for me to get somewhere. So I knew where the softball tournament was. So here I roll up in the clothes I had on last night, disheveled, you know, all of that, and I go to the softball game. My daughter's embarrassed. I'm embarrassed. Everybody, my friends are embarrassed around me, but they did. They gave me a ride back to the hotel where they were going to take my children, my daughter and whoever was with us home, and that I was going to get in my Cadillac, and then I had a friend that was near Hayward but in another town. I was going to go be with her. So they took my children home, and at that time they started the custody. This has been twice now that this has happened. So my husband retained a lawyer. His name is Preston. He has a high retainer. He's a very good lawyer, and he'll get what the person wants from him. Once I knew all that, they had a court date set for me, but they weren't gonna notify me. It was an emergency court set to see the judge in front of, you know, just him and the judge in the chambers to make this decision to get immediate custody taken away from me. You know, still parental rights, but right now no visitation, no nothing, possibly supervised. So I was working with the self-help, and I called self-help, and they said, you're on the docket for today, and you're supposed to be in court at this time. And, you know, so I showed up, and I looked over at Johnny and his lawyer, and his lawyer saying, no, and like, I know. I told him, I know. You know, like, you're not going to do this. And I don't know what kind of look I had on my face, but the judge was not happy with me. She said, what do you think this is funny, and what are you smiling about? And I said, I don't think anything's funny. And she immediately, right there in front of me, said, I'm taking your kids away. No visitation. No contact until further notice. And at that day, I got my children taken away. You would think I would get it and get it together to work very hard to get my children back, but that was like, took everything out of me, you know. My children are everything to me. They've always been everything to me, and I felt like I was a disgrace to them. I had embarrassed them tremendously. I embarrassed myself, my family, and, you know, I didn't get it. So after that, I went over to the coastal area for a little bit to get away, continued to drink, had company there, and, you know, my drinking was getting progressively worse. I was drinking at least a half a gallon a day. I could not drink. I had to have it with me at all times. If I didn't have it, I would start to have the tremors. I've had two seizures from it, and I passed out in the bathtub one time and almost drowned. I then went home, and so I'm drinking all the time. I'm constantly drinking, and I can't put it down. I get pissed off at Johnny again because I'm angry that he has my kids and he has my house and he has the business and he has the money. So he's out of town that day, and his parents live right next to him. So I go to his house. It was my nephew's graduation. So in my mind, I was supposed to be at the graduation, but in my mind, I was going to get what was owed to me. They're out of town. So needless to say, my sister said, you need to come to the graduation. I was no position to go to the graduation because I was lit. I couldn't talk. I couldn't walk. I mean, I guess I did an enough job. I drove the car over to his house, and I broke the bathroom door window, and I went in. I opened the garage. We have a Rhino that's like a four-wheeler or, you know, those quad things. And so, you know, I had my car, he had the house, I was going to get the Rhino. So I broke in, I opened the garage, I'm turning on the Rhino, my father-in-law comes out and calls the cops. I get on that Rhino, I take off, I go down North Ground in front of the big Catholic church there, and I hide in somebody's backyard, and I'm calling my sister, and she's at her son's graduation. Get the trailer, I'm at this place, come pick me up, we're loading the Rhino, and we're going home. The neighbor came out. By this time, there was so many cop cars after me. They even had the helicopter in the sky and everything. The lady said, just pretend you know me. I live right down the road. I won't harm you. Just when I get here, just say I'm here visiting. And she's looking at me like, you know, and I have one sandal on. I have a tank top on, and, you know, I think I'm in boxer shorts. So they got there. They wanted to give me a breathalyzer. I refused. Obviously, I was drunk. And so they took me in. They had to take me to the hospital first to make sure I was clear before they could take me in. So they got me there. They kind of detoxed me a little bit, and I went in. They got me for breaking and entering, Grand Theft Auto, and DUI. So I was in jail. I got booked. I had my bunkies. I was learning the system, you know. They give you Rice Krispie. They give you a boiled egg. If you don't, you have to save your cereal bowl to get water. So you can't get water until you have your cereal bowl and you eat it. And they give you a blanket. So the next morning, I'm calling. You have to have a landline at that time to call a home, and this is when everybody had cell phones. So I was calling my cousin's house because I know my mom lived right up the road and she could get her. So I called her and I said, I need to talk to my mom. And she said, I'll get her. She said, call back in 15 minutes. So I called her back in 15 minutes and she goes, are you ready to get help? She goes, we had an intervention planned for you first thing tomorrow morning, but you sabotaged that as well. You're in jail, so you're in a safe place, but I need to know, we have a bed for you at Changing Echoes. You will get in on Tuesday. I need to know if you're ready to do it, and I'll get you out. I said, I'll call you back. Because at that time, I didn't want to get sober. I didn't know how to get sober. I didn't want to get sober, and I didn't want to deal with life. So I went and talked to my new little friends I made and said, this is the situation. My mom's willing to bail me out, but I got to go to Changing Echoes for 30 days. But if I see the judge on Monday or Tuesday, I can get out on my own, and I can continue to drink. And, you know, and then as the day went on, like, I still hadn't called her back because I was really thinking about it. And I called her back and I said, okay, I'm ready. Me thinking, she'll bail me out, I'll get home, and I'll say I'm going to go, but not really go. So I get home, and my kids ask me, let's go have LTAP, you know, it's a place in Porterville before you go to Changing Echoes. My mom said, no, she's not leaving this house. I said, I'm an adult. My children are having to ask you if I can go eat LTAP. And then she said, no, we're not doing it. You're not leaving this place. I know what you'll do, and I'm going to get you help. And so we went to Changing Echoes, and I stayed there for the 30 days. I did really good. The day I got out, I was drinking. I was still, you know, doing the meetings, fake it till you make it. I would go to a speaker meeting in Visalia every time. I'd be crying in my life, and this is going on and that. And one guy kept telling me, keep coming back. I hated that word, keep coming back. Why am I going to come back? I can't get this, obviously. You're not helping me. No one's helping me. It was poor me, you know, the whole time. I got a job at a skilled nursing facility where I was a program, the social service director, and I continued to drink at that job, and it was a good paying job. And I had good intentions. I thought I was going to be there, and I thought I was going to make it, and I thought, you know, I'm going to get on with my life, because I was still going to meetings. I was still not trying not to drink, but then I drank here and I drank there, and it led to drinking every day, and I continued to drink. I got fired from that job. I went in drunk. I said some story why I looked the way I did and why I was all red and why I was all crying. I told them someone had died. I had to go to a funeral. I can't come to work today. And they said, if you want your job, we're going to go down and test you. And I'm like, I just took off running. I ran all the way home. I got, you know, let go from that job. And then, you know, I was still trying to do it. My alcoholism was, you know, my DTs were bad. I was ending up in the hospital. I was, you know, always hurting myself. There was always something wrong with me. I didn't have contact with the kids. I didn't have any of that anymore. My mom would try to get supervision. We had a couple of those, but I would go drunk or, you know, I would mess it up somehow. And so I kept going to meetings. I got another job. The last drunk I remember is getting so drunk that me and my roommate were having a fight, and I threw her down a flight of stairs, and we rolled together, and she hit her head and got a concussion. I hit the tile and got 2 black eyes. And I remember that because I had an interview the next day for a job. I went to that interview. I put a ton of makeup on. I covered it up. I wore like glasses that had a little tint on them. I got through the interview and I got hired. I was trying not to drink, to go to work, and to do what I was supposed to do. I had still been trying to go to meetings to prove to the court that I could get my children back. I remember having something happen at work, and they knew, my friend and my mom knew that I'd been drinking and it was kind of getting worse again, so they took the money out of my account. My mom was on my account, and I remember leaving work, walking from Tulare and Demarie all the way over to Houston, and every single ATM place I would stop and try to swap my card to get money. I needed money. I needed alcohol. I don't know what happened. I don't know how I got sober. I stopped drinking for 9 months. And I drank again, so I had to start over. I was going to meetings. I was meeting with sponsors. I was doing a lot of meetings. And on September 7th, 2009, I just said, I'm done. I'm not going to do this anymore. So from that point forward, I worked really hard to go back to court, to get my children back in my life. And it was baby steps. It took a long time. I now have, you know, the only daughter I have at home, she's 14. My other two have since graduated. I have her 50% of the time now. I walked away with a divorce from nothing. I didn't want alimony. I didn't want the house. I didn't want anything. I didn't want him to sign any check over to me. So he could think I'm where I am because he gave me the money, or I'm driving this car because he gave me the money, which was our money. But I didn't want that. So I started, I was still working at Kauia Manor. I didn't get fired. I moved back to Terrabella. Before all that happened, I started getting, recovery in me. I was homeless. I lived out of my Cadillac for a little bit and was showered in shape. There was times that I had nowhere to go. I lived in motels, and then I started cleaning up, and I went back to Terrabella, and I lived in, it's actually Deer Creek, but I call it Dinky Creek. My mom set up a trailer there and let me live there, and you know, she wasn't inviting me home at that moment, so I had a lot of proving to do. I would drive from there to Kauia Manor every day. I made $10 an hour, and I had this little Mitsubishi Eclipse that barely made it. You know, my children were embarrassed to ride with me. I would have to pick them up at a corner. They would get in the back. They would hide. I would drive. They were so embarrassed because that's not the life we lived, and that's not where we came from. I mean, but to me, that taught me everything. It doesn't matter what car you drive, how much money you have. If you don't have sobriety and you don't have a support system and you don't take care of yourself, because I always tell my girls, if you don't take care of yourself, nobody else is going to take care of you. And nobody can love you like you can love yourself. And I have been a great influence for them. They know I don't drink. Before, I would set my can down or my cup down, and they would ask me every time, Mom, can I have a drink? And I always say no. Today, they don't even ask me anymore. They just take a drink because they know I don't have alcohol in it. So I worked at Kawea Manor for 4 years, driving back and forth. My mom finally let me move in. I got a job at the county after 2 years of sobriety. I was a case manager for a year. I interviewed and I got program manager. And for 5 years, now I've been out of the county for 3 years, but for the first 2 years was very difficult for me. I wanted to pick up. I wanted to drink. I had the cravings. I didn't ever think that it was going to leave me. I thought I would have this forever. The one thing I learned through all of it, like I said, it's not the money. It's not the people. You know, you think that are your friends. You can have everything in the world, but if you don't have yourself, you don't have anything. And today, you know, I have great things in my life, but it's not important to me. What's important to me is me every day wanting to get up, get out of bed, go to work, do my job, enjoy my children, be around people that care and love me and support me, and continue to live my life through sobriety. I never woke up and said, hey, when I grow up, when the teacher asked you, what do you want to do when you grow up? Oh, I want to be an alcoholic. That was never my dream. My dream, you know, we had dreams of the same. But that's what happened to me, and that's where my drinking took me. But today I can stand here and I can say that I'm a proud alcoholic, and if I wasn't taken there, I wouldn't be where I am at today. And I completely enjoy my children and my work and my friends, and I wouldn't have that without sobriety. So today I introduce myself as an alcoholic, but today I'm a mother, a friend, a daughter, and a sister that I can be proud of. So with that, I'll keep coming back.